Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Our special guest tonight is Dr. Carl Ellis. Carl is the president of Project Joseph. He's the author of several books, including a book entitled The Changing Face of Islam in America. Right. Well, could you first of all just give us a little background on the book itself? What was the thought behind this particular project?
A lot of people in the church, when they talk about, there are some people who get this thing about wanting to minister to Muslims, right? And they decide that they're going to go overseas somewhere to do it.
Right.
And Larry Poston and I were trying to make the case that Islam is alive and well in America, and that if you really want to minister to the Muslim world, where better to do it than here? There's over 7 million Muslims here. And so, having decided that, we put this book together to really explain to the Christian community what's the nature of the Islamic community in this country, and some tips on how to reach out to Muslims with the gospel.
Well, before we talk about some of the specifics in that area, could you make a distinction for us between the Nation of Islam and the Islamic faith?
There are about 7 million Muslims in America. 3 million of them are African American. And when we talk about the Nation of Islam, I presume you're talking about Farrakhan's group.
Right.
In Farrakhan's Nation of Islam, there are a maximum of 20,000, probably less. So we're looking at less than 1% of African-American Muslims, okay? Now, the Nation of Islam, Farrakhan, by the way, there are other groups very similar to his, but the Nation of Islam technically really is not Islamic, because there are some fundamental beliefs that they have that are diametrically opposed to Islamic beliefs. They would be kind of like Jehovah's Witness would be to Christians or something.
Okay.
You know, are Jehovah's Witnesses Christians? They can't be, because there are some basic doctrines, Christian doctrines, that they deny.
By the way, I think it's important to point out that Dr. Ellis is one of the leading authorities on Islam. He's been sought out by various sources, secular and otherwise, to give some clarity to certain issues on this this subject. So he speaks from experience as well as training. Now, what are the challenges that Christians need to be aware of if they are attempting to try to win a person from the Islamic faith to the Christian?
Well, I think the first challenge of Islam is the way it's the Islamic way of viewing reality versus the Western way. All right, when we talk about the relationship, say, between life and religion. Mm-hmm. In the West, we view life as like a big rectangle, and religion is a small rectangle within it. That's not a biblical view, it's just a Western view.
Right.
Now, the Muslims view it just the other way around. They view the big rectangle as religion, and a small rectangle within that is life. So that's one of the challenges right there. It's just the way Muslims, I mean, when I say Muslims, I mean Muslims who are born and raised in a Muslim context, okay?
Well, now, would you say that one of the reasons it's kind of difficult for Westerners, and I don't want to just say Americans, but Westerners, one of the reasons it's difficult for us to understand the distinctives is because we maybe assume too much about the similarities between Christianity and
Islam. That's correct. We tend to look at Muslims in our own image, in a sense, you know. But the Islamic worldview is very much different, and Islamic theology, even though they believe in one God and all the rest of that.
And that's a very good point when you talk about the monotheistic aspect of Islam, because here's one of the things that people will say is that we believe in the same God. Whether you call him Allah or I call him Yahweh or Jehovah, it really doesn't matter. It's the same God. How false is that? Why is that dangerous?
It depends on who you speak to. I mean, Christians who speak Arabic refer to God as Allah. Allah is just merely the Arabic word for God. Now, when people around the world pray, if they speak Arabic and they pray to Allah, and they think of him as the creator of heaven and earth, and they're praying to the same God that we are, you know, even though they may have some wrong concepts.
Okay.
But then if we're going to look specifically at God as described in the Bible, and Allah as described in Quran. Two different gods.
Well, you mentioned the Quran, and that's obviously the
holy book of
that
Islam.
Is the holy book of the faith.
Right.
One of the other misnomers that we often hear is that there is much similarity between the Bible, or they will say there's little difference between the Bible and the Quran. Would that be accurate?
No, that wouldn't be accurate.
Okay, and why not?
Well, number one, the Bible came to us over a period of 1,500 years, whereas the Quran came to us over a period of about 22 years, okay? Quran is, the word means to recite. It's a series of recitations by Muhammad. The Quran does not, well, it's not organized in a chronological order. You know what I'm saying? It's just kind of all over the place. And then the various understandings. I mean, Quran does mention Jesus several times, but it does not affirm the biblical understanding of Jesus.
Right.
The Quran does mention Noah and Adam and all the rest, but it's in a totally different context. So Quran is about as similar to the Bible as Mother Goose is similar to the New York Times or something. You know what I'm saying? It's not.
Yeah.
It's they both happen to use language, but it's not the same thing. It's totally not the same thing. Now, a lot of Muslims will come at us and they will quote certain Quranic passages that say "Our God is your God" and that kind of thing. And but that was early in the time of Muhammad when he said that. He didn't really understand the nature of Christianity.
Now, would you please explain for the benefit of our listeners the relationship of Muhammad to the Islamic faith? Who is he?
Well, Muhammad is the prophet of Islam. That's just about the best way to say it. He is the prophet of Islam. He's the one that recited the holy book.
Okay,
and he's revered. He's looked at by Muslims as the greatest of all the prophets, and his whole life, the pattern of his life, has become the basis for Muslim community. I mean, now we talk about Quran. There's another reference that Muslims use. It's called the Hadith, and the Hadith is simply the traditions of Muhammad that are not, and the traditions or the sayings and doings of Muhammad that are not recorded in Quran.
Okay.
And to give you a kind of a comparative analysis, Quran is about the size of the New Testament. Hadith is about the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Okay, so we're talking about a much greater amount of material here.
Kind of like the Jewish laws.
Like the Talmud,
yes,
almost.
Exactly.
You know, yeah, in a very, very, very rough sense, yes, yes. All these traditions. And so from these traditions, from the Hadith, are derived most of Islamic law. And Islam is a religion of law.
Now,
that's it.
That being the case, especially in light of the events of September 11th, there's been a lot of talk about, well, these people were just living out their faith. Is the Islamic religion, is it a faith or a religion of peace? Or what we experienced on September 11th, is that the logical outworking or the logical extension of Islamic religion?
Okay, well, first of all, Islam does not mean peace as such. Islam means submission. And as Muslims understand it, it means submission to the will of God.
Okay.
Muslim simply means one who submits, or one who submits to the will of God. Now, let's take this, let me try to get you inside of the heads of these guys who crashed these planes into the World Trade Center, all right? You have what people call Islamist or Muslim fundamentalist or radical fundamentalist, however you want to say. They strictly interpret Islamic law. They believe in the literal, strict interpretation of Islamic law, right down to the letter. And when Muslims want to establish their faith around the world, what they want to establish is Islamic law. They're not running around trying to get people to receive Muhammad into their pumps, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know?
Right.
But they want to establish Islamic law. They want people to live by Islamic law, which is called Sharia, all right? Now, let's look at what's going on in the Muslim world today. There has been a resurgence of Islam in the last 50 years or so, a great resurgence of Islam.
In fact, you say it's a resurgence. statistics indicate that it's one of the fastest growing religions, not just in the East, but in the West. It's one of the fastest growing religions.
Yes, it's the fastest growing religion
here in
America. Okay. Fastest growing religion in the world, for that matter.
Okay.
It's about 2.75% growth. Now, granted, let's talk about this growth here. Much of the growth of Islam is biological.
Oh.
Yeah, Muslims have more children than Christians do. Okay. And when I say Christians, I mean with quotations. I mean,
yeah,
anybody who goes to church maybe once every other Christmas, I'd consider a Christian in this sense, you know. Not a fire baptized, born again, you know. Yeah. Right. All right. Yeah, but Muslims have more children than we do. The average age of Muslims in the world is younger than in the West. So it's largely grows biologically. However, it has gone through a great resurgence in the last few years, all right? Now, along with this resurgence have come great fractures in the Muslim world. There are some who are fighting for independence, such as in Kosovo. There are others who are internationalizing local ethnic disputes, such as in Palestine. There are on and on and on, all these crazy kind of things. There's all kinds of turmoil going on. And the reason that that's happening is because everybody's fighting, for one way or the other, the power and the influence of the non-Muslim world. All right? So, you know, now Muslims divide the world up into two camps.
Okay.
The House of Islam and the House of War. So if you're not in the House of Islam, you're in the House of War. So there's this great resurgence, but at the same time, there is a lot of tension and there's a lot of I heard one Muslim leader say he fears the balkanization of the Islamic world. You know what I'm saying? Just what happened in Bosnia-Herzegovina, all that crazy stuff going on. Mm. That's what's happening. Why is it happening? It's happening because of the influence of the non-Muslim world.
Mm.
What's the greatest influence in the non-Muslim world? It's the West.
Right.
What's the greatest influence in the West? It's America. What's the foundation of America's power? It's the financial system.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now you put all that together.
Right.
These guys, these Muslim fundamentalists, they see then the influence of the West, the geopolitical interests of the West, as new crusades against them.
Mm-hmm.
They have a growing sense of trauma left over from colonialism and the desire for identity and all the rest of those kind of things. And so therefore they see the infidel West as threatening the very lifeblood of Islam. Therefore, what you do when, you know, and Muslims have told me many times, we don't believe in going out and being aggressive in warfare against anybody unless we feel threatened. So these guys feel threatened. Mm. They see that the West and particularly America is threatening Islam. Therefore, they took it upon themselves to strike the vengeance of Allah into the belly of the infidel. And so you strike the World Trade Center.
Well, now,
that's why they did it twice.
Following that logic.
Yeah.
Okay, because sometimes we would think that we talk about the covert activities of U.S. foreign policy, things that most citizens don't know about, and
right.
we think that they are lashing out against some hidden wrong that that our military may have been responsible for. But now, if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying is the very presence of the thing that we represent as a nation. The thing that sort of drives us entertainment-wise, financially, et cetera, is a threat itself.
It's a threat
without
itself.
Without being overtly aggressive.
Globalization. Remember I said they view the big rectangle as religion and the small one life?
Right.
They look at the West and they see everything that goes on in our society, they say that's Christianity.
Mm.
So for them, they see all this Western decadence and everything that's ruining their kids. They say Christianity is a bad thing, so they're going to strike out. You know.
Wow.
Now that's the first thing, and then the second thing. Now you take like guys like Osama bin Laden, who was incensed by the presence of American troops on the sacred ground of Saudi Arabia. Because Saudi Arabia is where the holy sites are.
Right.
So he was incensed about that. And so he's gone. He's declared war against America. All right. Now let's look at another piece about some ways that Muslims view how then do you know you're right with Allah? Well, in Islam, there is no assurance of salvation. When I say salvation, I say that in a very loose sense.
Sure.
Because Muslims don't believe in salvation as much. They believe in they don't think they don't need salvation because they're not sinners in a Christian sense. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But how they get on the right path? Okay, mm-hmm. You've got to do the right thing and follow the laws and all that. But there's no assurance of how you stand with Allah. You never know. You just simply don't know, except if you die in a holy war, if you die in a jihad. Martyrdom, and they would call that martyrdom. Martyrdom will bring you straight to paradise.
Now
you put those two things together. Now, if I hijack an airplane, or if I strap dynamite around myself and go in, I declare a jihad against the enemy, I go in there and blow myself, I destroy myself and destroy 50 other people, or I crash planes into the World Trade Center, I'm going straight to paradise. And I'm striking a blow in the infidel. In the heart
well, now,
of the
what film. What we would call discipleship, what would be equivalent to discipleship, what would be the Islamic equivalent to that? In other words, you bring in a new convert, how would they be trained, how would they be prepared to live out their faith, especially in light of the threat of the Western world?
Well, they would learn the prayers, which are, you know, by rote. They would learn to recite passages in the Quran. They would, it's a lot of memory work. See, in Islam, there's this concept of knowledge. You know, Islam has developed over the years, okay? And somebody was asking me the other day, well, to a Muslim, how would he answer the question, why Allah did this or that or the other? I says, a Muslim wouldn't ask the question. Because the way Islam is, when I'm talking about Sunni Islam right now, they believe in knowledge without understanding. You just do it. Memorize it. That's it. Don't ask why.
Okay.
Maybe earlier, 200-something years ago, maybe that was permissible, but now it's not. You are forbidden to ask those kind of questions. This is the will of Allah. You just do it. And so a new convert would learn all the prayers and all the rituals and all the cleaning, washing ceremonies and all the rest of that, to recite certain things, to learn the 99 names of Allah, those kind of things.
I saw an interview with some women of Islam, and the host was trying to give some clarity because in the West we picture the women as being oppressed, and so the women were trying to prove that they were not being oppressed by their religion. What is the view of women within the Islamic faith?
It depends on where you are. If you go to Afghanistan, the women aren't happy campers at all. Go to Bahrain, well, it's different. Kuwait, that might be a little different. What's happening, what we don't realize is, what we in the West are very insensitive about is people's need for identity. Hmm. And one of the things behind the resurgence of Islam today is this drive for identity.
Okay.
When the Iranian Revolution happened in 1979, I mean, all these women, suddenly they put on all these, you know, hijabs and all that. What's going on? It was a part of the identity because they wanted to be distinct from the decadent West, you see. Mm-hmm. And so, a lot of women will get on and say, oh, they don't feel oppressed and whatnot. But then in other places, they do feel that way. It just depends on how you view it. Some women in Islam are very dissatisfied, and others like it.
Now, is there anything that Christians can do to offset the growth, especially in America, that can offset the growth of this religion?
Absolutely. Number one, about 90%. This is my estimate, and I think I'm pretty close to that. About 90% of Americans who convert to Islam consider themselves to be former Christians. Hmm. All right. So first of all, what we need to do is to do some exit interviews. And I've been doing some exit interviews with some of these people who convert to Islam, and I ask them why, you know. And they all give me basically the same answer. One, in Christianity, my issues were not addressed and my questions were not answered. And so I went to Islam. What issues? What questions? Mm-hmm. They share those with me. Easily answered in the Bible. Easily.
Okay.
But we in the church have neglected most of biblical teaching. And we have reduced the gospel of Jesus Christ in all of its fullness to a matter of peddling private fire insurance. And if you just don't happen to be in the market for private fire insurance,
Amen.
Then you're not going to hear the gospel. And so, one thing, we need to clean up our act. I mean, the growth of Islam in this country is not a measure of the strength of Islam. It is a measure of the weakness and retreat of the church.
That is a powerful statement.
And so that's the first thing we need to... We can't blame the Muslims for filling a vacuum that we've created, and we've created a vacuum. They've got a prime director to bring the whole world under submission to Allah according to Islamic law. We have a prime director to make disciples of all nations. Well, so, you know, but we want to make converts. You know, God makes the converts. We make the disciples. No, we want to make the converts, and we want God to make the disciples. That's what I call the great debacle.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.